Hello, I'm Nicole Lim, and this is Medicus the Podcast, the show that shines a light on the people whose very ideas are shaping the future of science and medicine. And today, I'm talking to two scientists who are concerned that in all our efforts to replace sick care with health care through better diets, more exercise, and regular health screenings, we're not talking about a fourth ingredient, one that is not only essential for good health, but our happiness too. My guests today are Associate Professor Joshua Gooley, who leads the Chronobiology and Sleep Laboratory at Duke NUS, and his research assistant, Hannah Yabuki. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Yeah, thank you.
So tell us, what is that fourth ingredient that we are overlooking in all the talk about healthy lifestyles?
I think the fourth ingredient is healthy sleep. So when you get a good night of sleep, it makes everything about your day just a little bit better. And I would position healthy sleep as another pillar of good health, along with having a healthy diet and getting regular exercise. Having healthy sleep actually impacts on a healthy diet and getting enough exercise. Because if you have insufficient sleep, you will be less likely to go exercise. You'll be more sedentary. And in addition to that, you might be more likely to seek energy-dense foods during that time that you're spending extra time awake.
So when we're tired, we snack more.
Yes, this has been shown in laboratory studies as well as in the field.
And what about you, Hannah? When you're sacrificing your sleep in order to study it, do you snack more?
Yeah, I would say that when I sleep maybe 6 hours a day instead of like 7-8 hours. So definitely in the shorter side, I do tend to reach more for sugar, for more chocolate. For that energy boost, but also it just feels a little bit out of control of like, oh, I really just have to have something sweet.
So what might seem counterintuitive is that if you stay awake longer, you'd think you'd be burning more energy, right? Burning more calories. And that might be the case for some people, but actually what ends up happening for many individuals who stay up late past their usual bedtime or doing shift work is they actually they consume more calories. They seek these energy dense foods to compensate for that increased time spent awake. So they end up actually taking in more energy than they expend.
That's why our work pantry is stacked so well with lots of candy.
And what are some of your go-to snacks?
I love the cereal drinks, like the little 3-in-1s. So I try to go for the lower sugar option, keeping in mind how it affects my health. but that's definitely something that we reach for. We have a lot of Milo as well that we do kind of go through as the shifts progress.
So sleep is important to our overall well-being and happiness. But what makes for good sleep? Is there a scientific formula that equates with good sleep, like a Newton's law?
Well, good sleep is something that not everyone agrees with, but I think there are some underlying commonalities whenever someone tries to define good sleep. So when I think of good sleep, I think of the sleep itself, but then also how you feel afterward. So when it comes to sleep, generally, in order to have good sleep, you have to have enough time in bed for sleep. The timing has to be good. It shouldn't be in the middle of the day, right? It should be at night. And then the efficiency of the sleep also has to be good. And that means having continuous sleep where you can fall asleep, within about 10 minutes or so. And then in terms of like the waking function and what follows a good night of sleep, if you feel alert and if you feel satisfied with your sleep, then I think the combination of these factors is what really defines good sleep.
But sleeping 7 to 9 hours is a good benchmark for most adults to keep us working well, physically and mentally. But there's still lots of room for variation. So Hannah, tell us a bit about your sleep habits.
I think I kind of just am perpetually sleep deprived.
I'm so sorry, Hannah, but thank you for your sacrifices in my lab.
But yeah, I think I just power through, but also just being relatively fresh out of undergrad as well, that I'm just, used to being tired all the time. So good sleep is something I've kind of forgotten, I think, in the process of just trying to juggle a lot of social obligations and a schedule that really fluctuates here and there.
So the context that Hannah just described, reflects her current situation. I would add to that there are individual differences in some of these sleep properties, like sleep need. Some people need to sleep longer than others in order to feel that they've had a good night of sleep. And certainly there are individual differences in like vulnerability to sleep deprivation. So while I think there are some commonalities for good sleep across different groups of people, there are these other factors at play, these individual differences, and then the social context in which we have to adapt can influence the way that we perceive good sleep.
And if we have a really busy social life, can we become more efficient at sleeping so that we can sleep less but feel just as well rested?
It depends what you mean by more efficient. Your sleep will change if you have this kind of lifestyle where you shortchange sleep on a regular basis. So the actual underlying architecture of the sleep will change. Your brain will prioritize deep sleep over other types of sleep. But that's not necessarily good for you in the long run, because it comes at the expense of other types of sleep, like REM sleep, that typically are it's deprioritized relative to deep sleep.
Do we need all these kinds of sleep? Or can we just do deep sleep and that's the best kind of sleep?
Well, deep sleep is certainly important. It is often associated with that restorative feeling that you get after a good night of sleep. But there's still a lot of debate about what these different sleep stages that we go through, what their function is. And there's some interesting evidence about stage-specific roles in memory. So for example, the deep sleep or slow wave sleep is thought to be important for declarative memory performance, which is memory of like facts or events, whereas REM sleep has been implicated more in motor memory and emotional memory. So there seems to be some functional divergence in the different sleep stages that we go through each night.
And there's been some attribution around housekeeping too, right? The brain does some form of cleaning up when you sleep.
That's right. So, one of the points I often try to make about sleep is that it's not a passive process. There are things going on, in your brain during sleep that are really important for performance and health. And so that housekeeping role that you've mentioned, there is research in animal models showing that when there isn't sufficient sleep, these housekeeping processes are disrupted. And they have consequences on the metabolic debris that can build up during sleep. So one of the functions of sleep is thought to be the clearance of metabolic debris that builds up while you're awake. And if that clearance doesn't happen properly, then it is thought to influence the function of your neurons.
But sometimes we just have a night when we have to work late, or we need to cram for an exam, or we simply can't fall asleep. How stressed out should we be about the consequences of a bad night's sleep?
I think an important thing to keep in mind is that it's not possible to get good sleep every single night. You can do all the right things. You can leave enough time for sleep. But in the end, there's so many environmental factors and pressures at play that influence our behavior that it's simply not realistic to expect that you're going to have good sleep every single night. I think what's most important is to keep in mind, what does contribute to good sleep for you? And if you, follow that kind of routine for yourself, then more often than not, you will get good sleep. So it's important not to obsess about getting a bad night of sleep. Everyone has a bad night of sleep once in a while.
And while it's easy to point to electricity as the root of all our sleep debts, getting enough sleep has been an issue that has plagued humanity for a long time.
So certainly with electricity and electrical lighting, we have much greater control over our diurnal rhythms. It's much easier for us as a society to stay up late and perform night shift work. But of course, there was shift work in the past, right? It was just done with different tools available. So I think that sleep deprivation has always been there. It's just that the contributing factors have changed. And so we have to be mindful of what the emerging factors are so that we can try to prevent unnecessary sleep loss.
And yet it is something that we continue to overlook in all our talk about healthy lifestyles. Why do you think that is, guys? Why are people not paying attention to sleep?
I think some people are. I just think that sometimes the public messaging isn't emphasized as much relative to some of the other important health factors like a healthy diet and exercise. Going back to what we mentioned at the beginning, where I feel like sleep is a pillar of good health, it should have equal play, I think, when it comes to public messaging.
I think sometimes there's this idea as well in my generation of having less sleep makes you stronger because you're spending more time studying. So especially from a more academic background, that's the way sleep has been packaged in a lot of the conversations I've had with people of like, yeah, I mean, I pulled an all-nighter, I finished the essay, and I didn't work on it before that, you know, because I could do it in the night before. So I think that's also one of the things that definitely contribute perhaps to that decreasing importance of sleep, at least in the younger generation, this idea that it's not as necessary because you can just push through and survive and then you can just reclaim it later on. But that maybe that later on never really happens. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Hannah's kind of hit the nail on the head here. I think that, you know, working longer is equated with like better, with a greater rate of success, right? And it's intuitive. If you work longer hours, you would think that, well, I'll get more done. Mm. But what is often overlooked is the efficiency, right? The learning efficiency or the work productivity. And this actually can take a toll if you're sleep deprived. So working harder, I think, is not nearly as good as working smarter. You can actually work fewer hours with greater efficiency if you're well rested.
The pandemic has allowed a lot of people, with desk jobs at least, to work from home, eliminating their daily commute. Has that translated into a sort of a tangible benefit to better sleep or more sleep at least?
Yeah, so one of the changes that we've, you know, seen during the pandemic is a kind of a shift towards later work hours and more flexible working conditions, including like hybrid arrangements. So this actually has influenced sleep behavior in a global way. So there have been many studies looking at how sleep behavior has changed over the past couple of years during COVID-19 in populations ranging from children to working adults. And while there are differences across studies, the general finding is that overall, people are getting about 20 minutes more of sleep per night. And that's probably because a lot of people can sleep in a bit longer, right? With the more flexible work hour arrangements, if you are, you know, a later type, then you might be able to actually push your wake up time a bit later and sleep a bit more than you normally would be able to.
So this could actually be part of a strategy for a healthier nation to have more flexible working times so people can play with their sleep hours a little better during the week.
Yeah, I actually think this is a period of reflection. It should be for all of us, because with the major changes that happened during the pandemic, there were some changes that maybe should stick around a bit, and we might be able to benefit from like the hybrid work scenario, at least with respect to sleep. So I think that we should pause and take a look and see whether or not we can continue with the improved sleep while at the same time return to normalcy as much as we can.
And how have your feelings changed about sleep since you've joined Josh's lab, Hannah?
Previously, I was someone who would study for however long as I could, because it did pay off. Like, I did get good grades, but I was also very cognitively drained. And since a lot of the work that I do requires me to be creative in my thinking process as well, making myself be more well-rested has reaped benefits, even if it does mean having to cut back on the hours I spend on the work that I do. So that's been really good. And I have been making myself sleep a lot earlier recently. It's a really weird change because my usual bedtime was 2 a.m. But now I've been sleeping by 11:30 p.m. And getting up at 7, 6:30 sometimes, just so I could get in early, get in some work, and then, you know, start my day nice and early as well. I think I've really grown to appreciate sleep a lot more, especially watching some of our participants who have really interesting sleep cycles. They sleep at 6 a.m. and they wake up at, 2 p.m. sometimes. So just that complete shift for me was very mind-blowing and made me appreciate sleep. And as I age as well, I'm still young, but as I'm aging and going through those stages, I'm forced to realize that I can't push through and with the same tiredness as I could when I was younger.
And so, for example, Hannah here, she's moved her sleep pattern from 2 a.m. to 11:30 p.m. For others, even 11:30 might feel unnaturally late. So there is still a range of sleep timings that work for us at different stages of our lives.
That's right. And there's a term that that sleep researchers and chronobiologists use to describe that concept, and it is chronotype. So you might have heard of night owls and morning larks. Mm-hmm. So these are descriptors that map onto chronotype. So there are individual differences in our sleep timing, and there are also age-related changes. And so, well, let me focus on the age-related changes first. Mm-hmm. So during childhood, it's very easy to go to bed early and wake up early. But then as you go through adolescence, there's a shift in the preferred timing of sleep, and that carries on through the university years. So in terms of your chronotype, you're at your latest when you're probably about 20 years old or so. And then as you age, your chronotype drifts earlier again, such that you return to preferring more of an earlier schedule. But then despite these age-dependent differences, there are still individual differences. So within any age group, there are some people who prefer to keep a later schedule and some who prefer to keep an earlier schedule.
And all of this is governed by internal clocks that chime throughout our body in different rhythms, but are ultimately guided by the light, even though they are really deep inside us.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So our underlying biology is a major determinant of your chronotype. It turns out that environmental factors also play a role in determining a person's sleep-wake preferences and chronotype. But certainly, your underlying circadian clock is a main driver of your chronotype. So circadian means about a day. So in our brains, we actually have a master clock. And this master circadian clock generates and synchronizes rhythms throughout your body that ultimately result in diurnal behavioral rhythms, like your sleep-wake cycle, but also rhythms in organ function. So every organ in your body is governed by circadian clocks. And what that means is that your daily physiological function changes. So that ranges from your metabolism to your body temperature. Everything follows a near 24-hour rhythm governed by your clocks. So you can think of this master clock in the hypothalamus of your brain as being the conductor of the orchestra. And this, this conductor is then synchronizing clocks in your brain and throughout your body to make sure that under normal circumstances, everything is in proper tuning with the light-dark cycle.
And Hannah, you regularly sacrifice your sleep for your research. How does it feel when you are fighting that internal clock in order to stay up?
Oh, it's really hard because it's really very much like hitting a sort of a wall at some points in time where you're just really tired. So I had a colleague of mine check the time during one of our shifts at 10 p.m. and go, you know, this time I'll be having my warm milk and stretching before bed. And you could really see the progression in his tiredness throughout the entire shift, but such that by the end of the shift at 4 a.m., he looked completely worn out. So I think it's definitely really hard. Fighting it is there's definitely a lot of really forcing yourself to not give in to what your body is craving, which at that point is usually sleep.
We've talked about how not enough sleep makes us snack more, but the effects of not enough sleep have really quite far-reaching consequences, reaching into every organ and tissue, some effects we might not even see initially.
Yeah, so sleep essentially impacts us in three major ways. One is cognitive performance, the second is mental health, and the third is physical health. So if you have insufficient sleep, then cognitive performance deteriorates. That's the most intuitive result, I think, whereby everyone has had a bad night of sleep or had to pull an all-nighter for some reason, or maybe they're traveling and they lost some sleep. So we all know how it feels. The next day, you feel tired, you feel a bit irritable. But what's a bit less intuitive, I think, are the effects on health, because they can manifest over longer periods of time. So when it comes to physical health, one night of short sleep is not going to result in a major change in your physiology. Mm-hmm. But a long history of short sleep over years or decades can take a toll on the body. And I think of this in the same way as smoking one cigarette is not going to have a major impact on your health. But if you smoke over the course of years or decades, it can. And the same thing is true for eating a large meal and taking in too many calories. yeah, if I overeat today, I'm not going to have a major health problem the next day. But if I have this kind of behavior in the long run, it does take a long-term toll on my health. So the same sort of thing happens actually with insufficient sleep.
But I think while most of us know deep down that we don't perform at our best when we've had a poor night's sleep, we also remember those moments, like during exam time, we stayed up late, we didn't sleep well, and then the adrenaline hits and we still perform well. We push through, perhaps masking the effect of not enough sleep. So we may not even realize, right, that we have a sleep debt building up.
Yeah, I think it really depends on how much sleep that you've lost. So if you've lost a couple of hours of sleep, then you might actually get away with recovery sleep, extending your sleep on the weekend by a couple of hours, that might be enough. But then when it comes to more severe types of sleep restriction, which many people do experience on a regular basis, where they report getting fewer than 6 hours of sleep per night during the school or work week, then it's not so clear how long it really takes for cognitive function to completely get back to its baseline levels.
But surely for most of us, a few missed hours here and there can be caught up over the weekend.
It certainly helps, but it may not solve the underlying problem. So I think that if your sleep loss is moderate during the week, meaning that you're undersleeping by maybe an hour or less compared to what you would prefer, then recovery sleep on the weekend may be enough. But I think many people are going to run into trouble with this strategy if they are more severely restricting their sleep during the school week or work week. So we and others have conducted research looking at some of the recovery dynamics after exposure to short sleep during a simulated work week or school week. And what's scary is that most cognitive functions do not seem to fully recover with extended sleep on the weekend. And then when you return to that pattern of short sleep again on the following week, then your performance immediately gets worse. And so it's unclear whether or not full recovery is possible across a weekend if a person is really restricting their sleep during the school or work week.
Okay, I'm now sufficiently scared. I am determined that I want to get a better sleep habit and sort of work on that. So how can I go about doing that?
Yeah, I think the first thing might be to look at what are your behaviors like before you go to bed. We call that your sleep hygiene. So sleep hygiene are like the set of practices or routines that you might follow in the period before you go to bed. And the reason why we care about that period is it's kind of that transition phase, right, from being awake to getting sleepy. So there's some, do's and do nots in that period. So some of the do nots include taking caffeinated beverages or doing any kind of like activating activity, like maybe video games. Or if you are one of those types who can get carried away on an e-device, of course, trying to avoid using e-devices in the period before you go to bed, like in the 20 or 30 minutes before you go to bed, can help you kind of shut down and wind down. So part of it is about finding the right routine for you too, right? Everyone has different preferences in terms of what how they like to spend their time. But if you can find the right kind of relaxing activity for you, which might be reading a book or listening to light music, or it could be reading the news, it could be whatever works for you. Yeah, if you do that and lock into that as part of your regular bedtime routine, then you can help yourself to fall asleep faster.
And what about you, Hannah? Having shifted your clock forward, what does your new sleep routine look like?
Yeah, I think it's very much sort of in the line of what Josh is saying in terms of not getting too lit before bedtime. So that's really sometimes meditation. This is very rare, though. I am not as calm as I seem when I say that. But for me to be able to shift my sleep patterns up earlier, that also required me to look overall at the way I was spending my time during the day and really restructuring that. So I'm in a position where I'm privileged enough to be able to do that, working, like a white collar job and all that. Obviously that's not necessarily the reality for a lot of people, but for people with whom it identifies with, of course, really making sure that you're blocking out your time appropriately, making sure that you get what needs to be done earlier in the day, and setting very strict work hours. So that was what worked for me in terms of making sure that I had enough time to do whatever I want and avoid bedtime procrastination, which is a very fun thing Josh can talk about as well. But yeah, so once I avoided that bedtime procrastination and was able to feel satisfied in terms of being able to do exactly what I wanted to do, I was then able to sleep earlier. So what's bedtime procrastination, Josh?
Yeah, bedtime procrastination refers to when you go to bed later than you intended, knowing that there will probably be consequences for that on the following day with respect to feeling tired. And it sounds like, why would anyone do that, right? But in fact, it's quite common because you know, oftentimes we're trying to kind of buy back time that we feel like we lost during the day. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of us have a lot of free time to ourselves. And sometimes a decision is made whereby we postpone our bedtime so that we get a little bit more me time. Mm-hmm. Even though we know that tomorrow morning we might be suffering the consequences, but in the moment, you know, you might feel like this is important me time, so I'm just going to do it and go to bed a little bit later.
And the other time, of course, when we choose to go against our own body clock is with travel, something that I think a lot of us are looking forward to after nearly 3 years of being grounded. So do you guys have any tried and tested tips for how to cope with jet lag?
I think a lot about this topic because I do a fair amount of travel. So I actually try to choose flight timings that work for me. So if I'm flying to the United States, for example, I prefer to arrive somewhere in the evening time. And even though I'm very tired when I arrive, I can push myself a bit to stay awake so that I can go to bed at the time that is appropriate for the time zone where I just arrived. And that's the key for me, is trying to go to bed at night at the right time in the new time zone. Yeah, so if I'm flying to Europe, for example, and I'm arriving in the morning, but I might feel very tired because perhaps I didn't get any sleep or very poor sleep on the plane, then my strategy would be to get a nap in the afternoon, mm-hmm. but keep it short, like less than 2 hours, so that I can, again, go to bed when it is appropriate in the new time zone.
So is the key going to bed at the right time rather than waking up at the right time?
It's a combination of the two, actually. But I find that if I go to bed at the right time, even if I don't have the best quality sleep that night, I'm still going to be waking up in the ballpark of when I want to in the new time zone. So ultimately, the way that your body adapts is through resetting of the circadian clock by exposure to the light-dark cycle. So by sleeping at the right time, you're actually avoiding light at the times when your body, you know, when it is appropriate, such that your body can adjust more rapidly.
And Hannah, what about you? Do you have any tips to share for how to cope with jet lag?
I think I pretty much do what Josh does. My time differences aren't so great, so they're usually within the realms of like an hour to 3 hours, because I travel between Japan and Australia a lot. But yeah, I definitely practice what Josh says in terms of trying to go to bed and waking up at timings that are appropriate to the time zone that I'm in. It does get a bit tricky with winter just because mm-hmm. it does get darker much mm-hmm. earlier. So that's great for me, though, because it does mean I want to sleep earlier as well. So I think it's also, you have to keep in mind the season that you're in. You know, if it's summer, then you have to really strategize a little bit more. Just like tell yourself, yes, it's really dark now, even though it's 8 p.m. and the sun's still out. It's really dark and I should sleep or get ready for bed. Yeah, I think that's how I approach it.
Thank you, Joshua and Hannah, for enlightening us on the importance of sleep, the often neglected fourth ingredient for a healthy and happy lifestyle.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you for listening. I'm Nicole Lim, and this is Medicus, the podcast. If you've enjoyed this podcast and want to discover more stories that take you behind the science that is shaping our world, why not listen to my interview with two intrepid scientists who study how viruses like dengue and Zika behave in mosquitoes and give us the lowdown on which repellents really work. And if you never want to miss another episode, hit subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts or on our website. Until next time. Goodbye.